Hello, my name is Ellie Ann, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. Today, I'm interviewing Dr. Matthew Guarigula, class of 2012, about his new book, Police and the Empire City, Race and the Origins of Modern Policing in New York. Dr. Guarigula is visiting Dickinson to give a Clark Forum lecture on his book. Thank you so much for sitting down with me for this conversation, and we're excited for your presentation today.
I'm very happy to be here. Any excuse I can to be back in Carlisle, I take.
So my first question is, for those of you listening who have not read your book, how would you define technocratic surveillance-based policing, and what are some of the practices in modern-day policing that listeners might not realize originated out of its emergence in early 20th century New York City?
Yeah, I mean, I think how I would define kind of technocratic and surveillance-based policing is the idea that police don't feel the need to rope like average citizens in the project of policing. This idea that, you know, we can build a regime of technology and surveillance that allows police to supposedly do their job without ever having to communicate with people or build cooperation between communities. So for instance, I think the classic example in the early 20th century that I give is fingerprinting. That if you could find a fingerprint at a crime scene, or if you could connect a person to their identity through their fingerprint, you don't need to be able to like ask neighbors, hey, what happened? Hey, who do you think did it? Hey, can you identify this person for me? Because, you know, based on the way police operate, there's a good chance that, you know, in the early 20th century, either the people police were trying to communicate with were immigrants who didn't speak English or didn't want to speak to police, or, you know, you have a situation where police have so destroyed their trust with the communities through police brutality, through corruption, through harassment, that people are unwilling to help the police, in part because they don't trust that the police, what they're doing is for the good. They think they might be trying to find somebody to harass them and not necessarily be trying to solve a crime. And so building a surveillance-based police system looks like a world in which we all have security cameras, and rather than talk to the camera's owners, police just try to get access to that footage without actually talking to the people in the neighborhood. So we've built a system in which police think that to solve crimes, they don't need to rely on cooperation or witnesses. They can use technology to do it for them.
Thank you for that answer. Following up to that, obviously your book is about the relationship between race and policing. So you talk extensively about the ethnic squads of Italian and German squads in the NYPD. Without this having happened, do you think that they would eventually have been racialized as white in American society? In other words, how are these ethnic police squads weaponized in race-making?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think without a doubt, European immigrants who came over to the United States were in some ways white, in some ways not. I mean, I think they were recognized as being not black, which I think is the operative term here, in the sense that, you know, if especially white police, but kind of white supremacist society in general, understood black Americans as the people who could never assimilate fully into society, European immigrants were not that. You know, they might have been different, they might have been foreign, they might have even seemed a little kind of like uncivilized, quote unquote, but they were always a type of people who over time could be compelled into becoming white and becoming American. Whether or not these new immigrant police would have become white sooner or not, or, you know, would have more privileges would have been withheld from them in society had they not joined the police force immediately, I don't think that's necessarily true, because, I mean, as we saw in other situations in the United States, a big place in which immigrants would differentiate themselves from black Americans was in the workforce, was in labor. And so even if you didn't have, you know, immigrant cops who were going into black neighborhoods and brutalizing people as a way of showing we are not like these people, we can participate in the American project of white supremacy. In the workforce, often that took the place of workers forcibly refusing to work the same jobs as black Americans. So you had them saying, like, you know, Irish workers would refuse to do these jobs or bar African Americans from getting these jobs to differentiate themselves. So I think, you know, the consolidation of white privilege around European immigrants was happening, and it would have happened had not police been very quick to bring immigrants onto the police force. But I think that policing was an important way that that happened incredibly quickly, especially because crime was so racialized as black, that having European immigrants go out onto the police force and show themselves at opposition to crime was in many ways read as being anti-black, which is what, you know, upper echelons of white society were hoping that these immigrants would do to prove that they were they could fit in white society.
The next question is also about your book. In chapter 3, you describe the systemic colonization of the Philippines through civic and benevolent institutions with a goal of creating, quote, self-disciplining subjects, unquote. So how do you think self-policing or like the idea of the panopticon looks for Americans today?
That's a really good question. I think that's so interesting in the sense that when the U.S. government was trying to decide how to govern the Philippines, they knew they could not have, you know, an American soldier with a rifle everywhere all the time. That although, intense military violence was part of it, the other part of it was conditioning Filipinos so that they would discipline, as you said, discipline themselves. They would become part of the structure of maintaining order. And so what this looked like was, you know, schools that taught to be civilized was to believe in American democracy, and to believe in American democracy is to do anything U.S. soldiers tell you. Churches who would preach similar things. You had all these different key institutions in society who all became subservient to this larger mission of trying to make Filipinos subservient to American military authority. And I think society kind of operates like this in general. I mean, it is a way of behave or else, right? It is like there is a, you know, the police represent the threat of violence if you do not behave by the rules of society. And so our institutions have been deputized in many ways to make us subservient to that. And you know, that's not to say that this is always bad, because in some ways this, what I'm just describing, is government. You know, like in the Philippines, it was really hard for American soldiers to find specific people, so they created standardized row names and addresses, and they put numbers on houses so that you could find somebody. And like, while this enables surveillance, it enables the government to find you, it also allows you to get mail. You know, so it's this really interesting thing in which modern governance, modern government in general, and the good things it can provide you, like your mail, like this U.S. Census, which allows for our representative democracy to work, it allows government to know about you, it allows them to know where you are, it makes you vulnerable to violence. If police want to send police to get you, they know exactly where you are. But at the same time, it kind of enables modern government. So in some ways, that is to say that we very much recognize in American society that we live in a kind of panoptic situation, and we recognize the kind of good things that government can do in our lives, but it comes down to trust and vulnerability. Do we trust the government we have with that information of where to find us at all times? For many Americans, the answer is no, because of a century of racial violence, because, you know, we know that the census was deputized to help find Japanese Americans for incarceration during the Second World War. So we have a long history of reasons why people should distrust the U.S. government. And in the Philippines, that was, you know, double. And, you know, in the Philippines, the panopticon there, the idea that all of government should be easily surveillable by the military, or else there will be violence, was so much more acute, and there was so much less good things to speak for it, even as they claimed they were, like, elevating the Filipinos to the level of civilization. And of course, when they say civilization, we can read that as white. So I think there are some parallels, but I think what it comes down to is just the understanding of making yourself vulnerable to government control. And for some people, that represents a good thing. It represents government services. And for other people, it represents vulnerability to violence. That's kind of a very long-winded answer to that question. I'm sorry.
No, I think that was good.
I speak like a real historian.
I want to talk more about the NYPD, since that's the focus of your book. So you talk about, like, the lack of evidence and, like, primary documentation. Why do you think, like, this evidence was destroyed? And for the documentation that was preserved and that you did look at, what significant information did you find that maybe altered your perception of the NYPD before and after?
Yeah, that's, again, a great question. The New York City Police Department is kind of a diligent destroyer of its own archive. In 1921, it took all of the remaining documentation it had to a pulp mill in New Jersey and turned it into wood pulp, pulp. So none of those papers from pre-1921 exist. Why they did it? Your knee-jerk reaction is you want to say they were kind of hiding things or they were covering up things, but I really think it was about the NYPD's relationship to information at that time. Policing until like the 1900s was not really predicated on documentation. Like, you would not walk into a police department and see like big filing cabinets full of information like you would later on, or now, you know, obviously police just rely on computers, but with those computers they collect a tremendous amount of information on people. And so I think part of it was space. I think part of it was, you know, the police precincts that police occupied in the early 1920s and 1910s were not built to house all the amounts of information that they started collecting once filing cabinets were invented in the early 20th century. And so I think, you know, there was just not a high value placed on a lot of that information, and I think there wasn't a lot of, at the time, space for it. But because because so much of the documentation I would have looked for to write this book I knew was gone, it opened me up to look at other things that I think you're absolutely right, very much shaped the arguments of the book. I think one of the key examples was knowing that I couldn't get a lot of documentation inside the NYPD, what I went is I looked at the personal papers of a lot of people who rose through the ranks and were like the inspector or the police commissioner of the NYPD, so the highest ranking people. And what I found when I got into their personal papers was their personal papers still exist because generally they were pretty fancy people. They went to Ivy League schools. Usually they were involved in politics. Their parents were involved in politics. They often went in and out of the military either before or after their time with police. And this kind of really made me realize the connection and the revolving door between the U.S. military and policing. So you have these police commissioners who, you know, were generals in the 1898 war, who were at the Philippines, who were in Cuba, who then became policing, who after their time in police went back into the military for World War I. And so getting into their papers and seeing how interconnected policing and the U.S. empire was and the U.S. military was made me like kind of rethink that connection and really shape the argument of the book.
Now to talking about like what you do now, can you describe what you do at the Electronic Frontier Foundation? Does any of the policy research that you do lead to policy change, or does it kind of just stay in that bubble?
Yeah, so the Electronic Frontier Foundation is a very cool organization that was founded in 1990. Which is it's membership based. So a lot of people, you know, they pay to support our work with memberships. And what we are, we're a collection of policy professionals, lawyers, lobbyists, litigators, and a lot of very cool technologists who kind of come together to make sure that technology supports civil liberties and doesn't hurt them in our kind of interconnected digital world. And so what I do is mostly focus on surveillance and privacy laws and policy. And yeah, I mean, I enact change all the time. I mean, a lot of what I do is try to push for better privacy legislation in this country. And that can take the form at the U.S. Congress of like, you know, major bills which stand up for people against technology companies and how they collect data and what they do with that data, or kind of intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies and how they collect data and what technologies they use. So I've been very involved in trying to ban government use of face recognition technology, which is incredibly invasive and dangerous, and which, you know, police in this country have shown time and time again they cannot be trusted with. But, like, even more obvious and acute things, I've been trying to push federal legislation that would close the what we call the data broker loophole, which is, you know, apps on your phone are collecting location from you all the time. If you go into your phone and you look at what apps have permission to know where you are, it's a surprising number of them, even ones that, like, aren't weather apps where they might, you know, it makes sense that they know where you are, but, like, you know, Cute Dog Picks Daily, they don't need to know where you are, and the reason why they ask for your geolocation is because they like to bundle that and sell it to data brokers. So people who target you with ads for restaurants in your area, they know where you are because apps are selling your location. And what we found is, if the government, if law enforcement wanted to know where you are all the time, they would need to go to a judge, they would need to explain why they want that information, and they would have to get a warrant. But because these data brokers sell that geolocation from your phone, what cops are finding is that they can just go and buy it. They can buy that data like they're posing as an advertiser and know where you are all the time without a warrant. So that's like a very obvious problem with a very easy solution that we've been trying to get past Congress. At the local level, it looks a lot more like trying to figure out what technologies your local police departments use, how they use them, and the very important question of what rules they have governing how and when they use them. Because for so many cities in America, there are really no laws saying that you or I have the right to know what technologies our police departments use, how much public money they're using to buy them, when they're going to use them, and how they're using them. There's just no rules or policies governing that. So a lot of my work is also at the very local level. So one example that is very cool that I'm very proud of is at the end of 2022, I helped to pass the United States' first ban on police using remote control robots to deploy deadly force. So in San Francisco, police were trying to get through the city council a policy that said in emergencies, police should be able to send robots into a situation armed with, strapped with a bomb to neutralize a threat. And we turned what would have been approval of this policy into the first U.S. ban on police using robots to deploy deadly force, in part because I just do not foresee a scenario in which that would ever de-escalate a situation or lead to more safety for all. It just doesn't make a lot of sense that police want this in their toolbox, is sending a robot with a bomb on it. It just seems like a way of ensuring collateral damage, and so we helped that policy in San Francisco, and because it's the kind of first of its kind, I'm very proud of that fight.
Awesome, thank you. Throughout your research of the history of policing in New York City and subsequently urban areas, what is your outlook on the purpose of, and existence of policing itself? You've talked at length about, like, issues with policing, so do you think that there simply needs to be reform of the system, or do you possibly believe in complete abolition, and, like, what would that look like practically for the United States?
Yeah, I mean, this is the big question, right? I think that to study the history of policing is to see firsthand that police reform doesn't work. That the reforms that we try, the reforms that politicians are always proposing, have all in some way or another been done before. I mean, the history of policing is a history of police reform because from the very beginning, there are problems with police are too brutal, police are too corrupt, police racially profile. How do we fix this? And so they've been trying to reform this system for 150 years, and you know what? It doesn't really work. Not just because often when a police commissioner or a politician says police can no longer do this, having that translate and trickle down to the rank and file often doesn't work. You know, like, police departments have banned chokeholds for decades in some places, and yet we still see police use chokeholds. There are some cities in which high-speed car chases are banned by the police, and yet police when push comes to shove, still do hyperspeed car chases. So it's very hard to get rank-and-file police to kind of upend the embedded culture of policing and change the way they do things. But also because a lot of police reforms become their own problems that need to be solved further down the line. People thought that body cams were really going to be an answer for police accountability. And then what they found out is that police were putting face recognition on body cameras. And when a person came up to police to report a crime, they would get an alert on their phone and they'd say, the person in front of you has an unpaid parking ticket, arrest them. And so body cameras, which were supposed to be about reform and accountability, became a new tool of surveillance. Or when you gave police the keys to control the footage, they were cutting and splicing body camera footage to make it seem like their version of events happened. So really, tools of accountability did not help. So reform kind of becomes a new hurdle that we have to deal with because police were able to manipulate it to their own ends, or they created new problems. And so I am a person who thinks that because I'm a historian of policing, that the institution of policing is incredibly antiquated. It is like using leeches and bloodletting to, you know, treat disease. It is an outdated thing. And like in the history of medicine, if you have a sickness, like if you think about crime as like a problem that we as a society want to address, and you've been trying one solution for 100 years, and that solution, that treatment does not treat the illness, it might be time to try something new. And I think that policing, because it is so politically embedded in our society, because when people ask for safety, politicians think the only solution to give them is more policing, we've been shortchanging other more innovative solutions that we should be looking toward. And I really think the time has come, especially if you like care about public safety in a holistic way, if you care about protecting communities from crime, you have to start to think about the root causes of crime, and how to address those, and a lot of the money we could be using to address those root causes are right now locked up in paying, you know, hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, depending on where you live, overtime for police technologies, militarizing the police, or the hundreds of millions of dollars that police departments pay out every year in civil rights law settlements. Like, people don't realize how much money the NYPD pays out just to settle lawsuits against the NYPD for brutality. It's a tremendous amount of money. And yet, if you look at the NYPD right now, the mayor of New York is proposing closing public libraries on Saturdays and Sundays to give that money to police to address crime. But things like public libraries have been shown to decrease crime, because when people have places to go, when there are services that are accessible to them, you build a culture that is not so so desperate, that has not been so marginalized and so abandoned by government, so as to build cities that in which people feel like crime is their only resort. And so I think what that looks like practically is giving money to mutual aid programs, to violence intervention programs. And some of these might be run by the city, and some might be run by the community themselves. It looks like more services. It looks like better housing and better health care and better schools and more food security for neighborhoods. Like, all of these things would probably do more to address the natural ebbs and flows in crime than policing has in the last 150 years. And also just like building alternate institutions to the police, building crisis teams that can address unhoused people when they are in crisis that are not armed police, that might end up just arresting homeless people or putting them into the system or hurting them. And same thing with mental health crisis. Like, we have to send people who are better at de-escalation, who aren't armed, who aren't eager to use deadly force, to situations where they're addressing mental illness. I mean, the amount of times I've seen police get sent on a wellness check because family is concerned a family member is suicidal, and it ends with the suicidal person being shot by police is astounding. Also, the fact that we still have armed police, the people we send to shootouts, are the same people who are pulling people over and giving speeding tickets, makes no sense and is a recipe for violence and has been since the 1840s. It feels like a very, very antiquated technology that we are still clinging to because we're so attached to it. But I think it's time to innovate. It's time to move past policing.
Thank you. Last question. You are an alumni of Dickinson. Do you have any advice for current undergraduates who are passionate about policing and incarceration? Are there any resources that you would point them towards to learn more? Of course, your book, but other than that.
So much. For Dickinson students who are passionate about social justice, about criminal justice reform and abolition, who are interested in, you know, curbing this long and really shameful history of racial state violence, I think first and foremost is listening to communities, listening to people who are the most subject to racial state violence, in part because a lot of communities already have solutions. They have proposals. They are well organized. There are organizations within those communities, and seeing how you can make yourself of service to groups who are already doing the hard organizing work is first and foremost one of the most important things you can do. And in part because, you know, when you listen to communities, you also see that the people who are most subjected to police violence are also the people who are sometimes most concerned with crime. And so coming up with solutions that addresses both of those things is, you know, has to be an entwined solution. It has to be community-led. So I think that is one of the more important things I can do. And there are, a tremendous amount of organizations, and it's very place-based. So the communities that you love, the communities where you live, where you get involved, where you want to get involved, keep your ear out, lend your body to protests, lend your body to the movements that need people, pay attention to what's happening in local elections. You know, so much of this often comes down to your local prosecutors, your local district attorney, your local sheriff's election, who can often controls the county jails. So really, I think paying attention to what's happening locally is the first step. Other than that, there are a lot of big national organizations that are doing the work. A lot of them have internships for people who are interested in getting involved. Read a lot. See what publications are publishing, the best news that you're interested in when it comes to the criminal justice system, when it comes to who's covering racial violence the best. Reach out to those organizations. See if you can pitch an article. See if you can pitch an op-ed about what's happening in your community. I think both national and local press have an important part to say in, like, reporting about some of the best stories we hear about, like, atrocities that are happening in county jails are coming through local news. So support local news. Read your local newspaper. See if you can get involved through that way. In terms of making a career out of it, an important thing to do is to cultivate skills, some of which you learn in college and some of which you learn at college, but not through your classes. A lot of the skills that were most important to me, things like organizing, things like talking to other students about important issues and making sure they come out to protests, things like writing for the public. I wrote for The Square my entire time here, which, at the time was kind of an alternative political magazine, as well as humor and arts and culture. So, honing those skills of writing for the public, honing those skills of planning a protest, attending protests, learning how protests work, learning what concern people, are all things you can learn at college, but not necessarily through classes. So definitely cultivate those skills.
Thank you so much. To our listeners, I encourage you to watch the recording of Dr. Garigula's lecture from Monday, March 4th at theclarkforum.org. And once again, on behalf of the Clark Forum, thank you so much for sharing your time and perspective today.
Thank you. Thank you for this amazing interview, and thank you for having me.